Welcome to Give Theory a Chance, Sociological Life Lessons. Today we are joined by Christopher Connor. Chris is an assistant professor of sociology at University of Missouri Columbia. Chris has recently published an edited book titled Conspiracy Theories and Extremism in New Times. And just 2 years ago, I believe, you also published a book titled Electronic Dance Music. Chris has also published journal articles on a wide variety of topics, including online dating, QAnon, and also using the game Werewolf to teach symbolic interaction, among a whole plethora of other topics. And then most importantly for me, you've agreed to be the first recorded guest for my new class, which is titled Sociological Life Lessons. And I really appreciate you being willing to be the first person to have this conversation. So thanks for agreeing and thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
For people watching, people listening, the idea of this class, it's the first time being offered at SUNY Brockport. My basic idea is we as researchers, whether sociologists, geographers, people in gender studies, anthropology, we do a lot of great research. And sometimes we don't take that final step of saying, to our audiences, often students, here's how you can take this idea that can sometimes be abstract, or even if we're trying to make it really grounded, but say, here's how you can take it into your own life. And whether that's saying, now that I understand how this institution works, it can help me operate better, whether that shifts our understanding of who we are. But I think we have a lot of lessons to offer, and we don't always do that. And sadly, what we've seen in the public space online, other people have taken they've chosen to occupy that space. They've chosen to be the experts. And we often point to them and say, well, those lessons aren't good. And that's not good for society. And that's not actually right. So I'm hoping that both in this class, so for students at Brockport, but then also making this publicly available, we can say, here's some of the cool research that's happening there. Here's voices like yours who care about doing public sociology. What's a lesson or two that we can take from our research? So that's the idea, at least. That's the experiment.
So it's refreshing to hear somebody else say that. So my career kind of took a winding path, and probably this interview will too.
Yeah, but that's the fun part.
But yeah, I recognized early on that there's this kind of disconnect we have with like the research we do in the public. And so until recently, I wasn't in a position that required me to publish so heavy. What I had to do, like what I did to stay active was I made contact with outlets like Salon, The Conversation, these kinds of things, because honestly, I get more of a kick, more of I feel like I actually did something when I write for like a broader audience. And there's a reward that comes from it. Now, the funny thing is I found out that I was actually able to like reference my articles. And so like, if you look at the number of views on some of my articles, they're like super high. But I didn't go into it with that. I went into it with, hey, how can I get my research out there into the people's hands and reach a broader audience? Because like there's a joke in sociology that we often write for 10 people, and that's largely true, right? But I found out by doing this kind of public sociology route, it like some of my articles have like thousands of views, which just boggles my mind. But it's all because that I took this initiative to find other outlets, and I was at a point in my career where I could do that kind of stuff.
Did you, when you're choosing the topics that you're writing on, do you intentionally choose ones that lend itself to that type of public sociology, or rather did your interests kind of push you that way? Because looking at that list of things that I was talking about, all of those that should be exciting beyond just 10 people, right? If you're writing about conspiracy theory, if you're writing about queer spaces in rural environments, if you're writing about electronic music, that should interest people beyond just the 10 experts who are thinking about the theory that you're using.
So I like to tell people that I'm an unlikely candidate to be holding a PhD in sociology, let alone in front of a group of, you know, hundreds of students each semester. I went into this kind of business of sociology because I wanted to understand stuff that I saw in my own life and make sense of it. And what happened was kind of, I don't know, by accident almost, that I became really good at writing. And I found out how to understand what I was experiencing through the awesome thing that is sociology when it's done with a heart. Like, so I get a really frustrated with parts of sociology because I feel like it doesn't speak to the people, right? Like, this is stuff that C. Wright Mills talked about, or W.E.B. Du Bois, all these folks. And I kind of sought out to like understand my life through this lens of sociology. And like early on, like I can remember, this is a, oh man, I don't know what triggered this story. I can remember being in a nightclub setting up for a band known as My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult.
Because you have a background as a promoter, right? So that's a key point, right?
Okay. Yeah, I came into sociology. Starting out, I wanted to do like music. I wanted to be a nightclub promoter or like a promoter for like Live Nation or something. But I knew that like most people, that's not necessarily a stable career path, right? And so I always kept taking classes and going to school because, you know, you got to eat, right?
Yeah.
And so like I can remember setting up for a show, I think it was My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, and finishing my master's thesis and going, all right, cool, now let's do sound check. And so I kind of had this weird path into academia where I understood, or I wanted to understand my life through the lens of sociology. I saw that it was powerful and it could explain everything I was experiencing, whether it be like who shows up to a, you know, a live music event, all kinds of things like how we develop our identity or who believes in conspiracy theories or like bigger questions. And so it might've been that like music and electronic dance music and all these things got me into sociology. But now the stuff I'm doing is beyond that. Now I'm interested in what some might call more traditional sociology, in that I'm interested in studying inequalities, power, that kind of stuff, and making an impact that way.
So you have a few different areas of interest that you've published on that would lend itself well to this goal of saying, all right, so what's a lesson that people can take from it? Do you want to choose one of them? And we can, I'm curious if you could introduce one of those topics and talk a little bit about what it looked like to start doing that research, what inspired you, and then we could talk a little about methods and where you went with it. But it's going to be hard to talk about all the different topics because you have a few different directions.
So this is actually good practice because I'm getting ready to go up for tenure and promotion. So I need to like, you know, tell a story about that makes sense and coherent, yeah. Right? For starters, I was always in this kind of temporary labor market, and so I didn't have to like drill down on one specific topic. And so I was just like, all right, I'm interested in this. I want to go study this. I'm interested in that. Like, but here's the thing. All of my research focuses around the online life. Like, what is this digital space doing? How is it shaping our lives, right? So like my first publications on Grindr and gay dating apps and how we reproduce inequality in what should be a really private space, but it isn't, right? It's in some ways it's become the new gay bar, right? And I really hate that too, by the way. And then, you know,
what say more about when you say you hate it, say more.
I hate
not to do some sort of like,
right.
Really get into it. Oh, I should have said I failed in the introduction because the way that I initially found your work and then I tracked it back to your academic work is because you have a really good Substack that does a great job of really writing in an entertaining manner and then referencing academic and sociological theory. So at the end, I'll have you say the name of it, but sorry to interrupt. But
oh, no, that's actually really cool. I would have never guessed that's how you found me. I just, sometimes I feel like when I'm writing for that, I'm just screaming into the void.
I heard you screaming. So
someone came to rescue. Okay.
Yeah. The question was, you said that you said these apps are, in a sense, are serving as a new gay bar, and you said you hate that. And I was just curious, why?
I hate it because it flattens out the human interaction, right? And it reduces it to our most banal characteristics, right? And it allows for people to act in ways that they probably wouldn't otherwise. And I'm not immune to that, by the way. Like, I'm a human being like everybody else. I'm sure I've done some dumb stuff online that I shouldn't have. But what interests me in this space is how quickly we reproduce social hierarchies of beauty, of class, of racism, almost at warp speed, right? So, like, I don't think some of the things that people say to people they would do if they were at a physical location, because they would probably get their faces punched in. I say that with all due respect, right? But some of the behaviors that people engage in online are just horrific, right? And so kind of the starting point for that whole line of research was, I was like, hey, there's a lot of sociology on these dating apps and nobody's really writing about it. Why is that? And I got a lot of pushback on getting those articles out there. Even today, I still get pushback, but it's different. It's not as much.
What was the pushback more for, concerns about the methods that you're using or just the topic? Like, what were people, because it, like you're saying, that's incredibly sociologically rich area, and it's also becoming a dominant way that people meet each other.
So if you want my honest opinion, I think I had three reviewers. Only one of them understood what social media was. And because like the arguments that I had to defend my work against were not something I would expect from someone who's of a particular age, let's say. And
how did you do the research? Because one of the challenges with online, I mean, you could, if you're looking at message boards, obviously you could do content analysis of what people are saying, but you're looking at dating apps, so it's not a public posting. So I'm curious, how did you, what kind of data did you collect? What method did you use?
So there were some interviews I did. And I would actually have to go back now because it's been so long. I want to say somewhere in the ballpark of like 20 to 50 interviews. And some of that stuff is like on the cutting room floor. So it doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
But sorry, ADHD. It began as like, hey, I just want to analyze people's profiles and what they say. Because at the time they were really like saying some horrifically racist stuff. And I put it in the article too, which that got a huge pushback because there was concern about the anonymity of the data. And but these are like, for the most part, headless profiles. Yeah. De-identified, but also I think it would be extraordinarily hard to track down who those people. I don't think I could track down who those people were to this day.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that came about. And I feel like I'm doing a horrible job answering your question.
No, you're getting it. So you were looking both at profiles, which in a way are publicly available, because if you're in the geographic region and you have the app, then you see the people, and then you're interviewing people about their use of Grindr and other dating apps, right?
Yeah. One of the interviews, actually, this was kind of interesting. One of the interviews was with someone who I knew not very close anymore, but not because of this. All right. Yeah. But I found out So there's the first article that came out, which is like, hey, here's all the crazy stuff people do on Grindr. And then there's like a follow-up piece in, I think, Deviant Behavior. And as I was trying to write that second piece, I got some pushback from the peer reviewers, and they were like pushing me on different ways. And I said, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write about how white people reproduce racism on the app, because one, like, some of these guys you get talking and they will hang themselves. And so there's the second article in Deviant Behavior where I talk about, you know, how racism and like, they don't even see what they're doing as like racist, right? They just see it as like, oh, that's just what I'm attracted to, bro.
Yeah.
And like, they're unwilling to interrogate that further. I was actually, so one of the, I won't tell you the details, but one of the participants in the study, I was able to get to like, open up and really think about things. And the next thing I know, they're like hooking up with people who they wouldn't have hooked up with before.
Which I guess is a public sociology of sorts, I suppose.
I guess, I don't know. I'm not saying I fixed him, but I am saying I at least got him to interrogate his preconceived biases and notions, which at the end of the day, that's really all I want, is people to like, look at what they're doing, look at how they're reproducing inequality, how they could do better.
And so when people were saying things which they did not initially perceive as racist, because this is hard to do when you're interviewing someone about a sensitive topic. So they would say something about like, oh, I'm only interested in having sex with white guys, something like that. So then you would follow up, and how would you handle the next step? Would you immediately call them out, or would like, what do you do to maintain that rapport? Because you don't want them to walk away.
Yeah. Right? You know, so like, again, you kind of just, one of the coolest tricks about ethnography is just staying quiet.
Yeah.
And making people live in uncomfortable silence. And this is a great trick for people who teach class, by the way, is just don't, and you'll be like, oh man, I gotta say something.
Yeah.
And just no, don't do it, because they will eventually hang themselves. And that's kind of what happened. And you could kind of push them a little bit, but you got to be careful how you do it, because you don't want the interview to end.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of how that went down, is like when I was also using my whiteness as a way to leverage other white people to talk about stuff that, you know, they... I mean, I wish these guys could hear themselves, honestly. Like, some of the things that they said, and, you know, I didn't publish everything. I try to make people look as good as possible, but, you know, it whatever it is about this online space, about dating apps, it allows people to think about race, or rather not think about race, like to reify it, right? To treat it as it's a real thing, rather than a social construct, and then to not interrogate where those ideas come from and how they reproduce them in their own lives. And so, like, for me, that's the real impact or importance of that line of work on gay dating apps, is get people to think about how they're treating other people, and how they can do better. And also, personally, I think the dating apps suck. I've always done better in person than these online apps. And some of my partners, actually, we didn't meet online. We didn't even meet at a gay bar. We met at a weird goth night. So,
when you were interviewing people, how much did you draw on your own identity and your own experience as a way to enter into certain questions? Because that can be a useful way to build rapport too. And then other people would say, no, you should try to remain, keep distance, and not make those connections. I'm kind of curious how you approached it.
Yeah, so Gary Allen Fine has an article about this, and I think he says that any sociologist that studies a world that they're part of is basically stupid. And I am, like, totally against that, right? Because that's my whole career is studying my own life through the lens of sociology. And it at times does get depressing, right?
Yeah. It can ruin things that you love very quickly. Like a risk of,
Totally. It has, so my other line of research is electronic dance music, which is my dissertation. And it is only now, so that was like, what was that, like 2015? It's only now that I am back to like loving dance music again, because it totally killed it for me for a really long time. I didn't want to go to anything. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I didn't care. But now I'm back at it. I showed you my turntables. Like I'm very much involved in that music again, but it took me a while.
How did it ruin it? Was it that you just had to think about it so intensely that you needed a break, or was it that your research revealed some ugly sides of this scene?
Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah.
Not either or.
The first thing that happened was I went and so my dissertation, which became a book, is on basically the Electric Daisy Carnival, which happens in Las Vegas each year. And it's got a couple like satellite locations. One's in Florida. I can't remember. One's in Rothbury, Michigan. Anyway, it killed it for me because I was going to these dinners with these really respected, high profile dance music artists in Las Vegas, and they were just some of the most awful human beings that I'd ever been around. And so it kind of killed it. It demystified it, and it showed me the real life of, it showed me a side that I didn't want to see, basically.
Which is interesting because social media gives us access to celebrities and it's a classic don't meet your hero type thing, right? But social media gives us access to our heroes and celebrities in a way that we've never had before. And I think about the relationship that students have to people that they're, whether it's music, whether it's athletes, whether it's, actors, it's like they get to see sides of them that we never would have been able to find out unless we saw some like long profile piece in whatever magazine. And even that would have already been through a different type of filter. And for you, you're getting like sitting at the table talking to them.
It was wild. So one thing I will say is, shout out to the Crystal Method. They were like instrumental for me gaining access to a lot of stuff. And they turned out to be like the most real DJ group ever. But celebrity culture aside, it really kind of ruined it for me. So I guess my advice to your students is be careful what you study, because you may ruin it for yourself and then you'll never want to pick it up. Like it took me literally 10 years to like detox from all the horrible stuff I saw. So to a point where now I'm like, okay, I really love this music again.
When you write about, especially when you're writing in more popular outlets, do you ever send what you write to some of the people in the scene, or is it more you just put it out there and see where it falls, let people discover it?
Honestly, most of my contacts, they will occasionally respond. So there's a, I don't know if I can say his name or not. So I used to work for a promoter agency. There's a character known as Disco Donnie, and I love Donnie to death. And he actually, he wrote a really nice review of my book. It's on the back cover. For the most part, I don't have access to that level anymore. So like,
Once you leave it, you don't really, it's not like you're still can just email that DJ or something, right?
Yeah. It made doing the dissertation kind of hard, because as time went on, people were slower and slower to get back to me. And now they just are like, who the fuck are you? And, and also I think if they actually read my work, they're like, ooh, I don't know how I want to get it. I did do a test run with a promoter out of Chicago who turns out to be a really lovely person. So I think most people don't actually read my stuff. So, but they're a pretty low level like promoter. But
I'm curious if going across these different areas of interest, were there particular theorists that you were inspired by or found useful in the field or just when you're doing analysis? And especially going back to the fact that one of the things I enjoy about your Substack is occasionally you'll bring in a social theorist from, 1800 or 1900. And then you're like, no, this relates exactly to the experience I had last weekend or whatever you're writing about. So I'm kind of curious who the social theorist or theorists you found inspiring, who were the ones you found inspiring?
So I remember the moment, actually. I can remember the exact moment. I was in the man who would become my second father, dissertation supervisor in his class. He was giving his lecture on the culture industry, Horkheimer and Adorno, the Frankfurt School. And I just could not get enough of that. I was like, what is this? This is what I've been looking for through 4 years of undergrad and, 2 years at a separate master's program. And then all of a sudden I find it like week 8, maybe in this seminar class. And I was like, this is it. And after that, man, it was on. Like I read everything I could get my hands on. Before that, I was kind of a little, I won't say lazy, but nothing had moved me in the way that this stuff did. And I was like, that's exactly how it is. I know, cause I lived that life. Like this is it. And, then from there, the rest is kind of like history. Like,
what was it about their writing? I mean, it's difficult. It's kind of putting you on the spot, but were there particular things that, I mean, you were saying they were right. It was spot on. You could see it. You could see it in what you're encountering in your own life. But were there certain aspects of the critiques they were offering of society, of culture, that you're like, that actually gives me a way to understand this thing?
Essentially, like a lot of Horkheimer and Adorno's writing is about how the political element, the edge, as it were, gets kind of taken out of the culture industry to make it really accessible to a mass audience. And I can relate to that, because if you try to have something that's too smart or too edgy or too, that makes people think too much, man, talk about a way.
It's not easily consumable, right? Yeah. That's challenging in some way.
Yeah. And so from that angle, like that's something I can point to. But everything they wrote about it was like, oh yeah, man, I can, this plugs in here, this plugs in here. It totally explained what was way too long of a period of my life, frankly, and illuminated it. And after that, I read everything. It didn't matter if it was related to my topic or not. I read everything. In fact, it was kind of funny. The grad students in my program would come up to me and ask me about the reading for the week. And there was this particular class and I would like be the first one to answer. And the professor would not like my answer at all, but they all hadn't done the reading and they were just using my notes. And he would be like, oh man, that's so your spot. I'm like, that's my stuff, man. Once I found out that there was something out there that nearly explained a huge chunk of my life, I was sold. I was like, this is where it's at. Sociology is awesome. And, and I'm still a sicko to this day. Once I get like on a topic, I read everything, and it is like an illness, frankly.
Yeah. It's an illness that we get rewarded for within the career.
Sometimes, right? Sometimes we get rewarded for it.
Optimistically.
Yeah.
Wait, so I've got this for reading, thinking about the Frankfurt School, It makes a lot of sense the way you're describing, especially thinking about electronic music. Was it also, were those theorists also useful for understanding dating apps? I'm kind of curious about that. Because that connection in my mind, I don't see the, like it, for the dissertation topic, like it clicks immediately. I'm curious if you see a connection there too.
So I've done a lot of these, and I think that's the first time anybody's asked that question. That's a good question. So yes and no. So the thing about the online world that differs from the dance music stuff is the online world really, what Marx would say, mystifies or makes hidden how things actually work, right? So, people are just sorted into a grid, but like, and I'm talking about Grindr here specifically.
Yeah.
But there's also like, now there's like kind of gamified elements that, you know, you can like get your profile boosted so more people can see you, this kind of stuff. So it makes the culture industry stuff harder to see, but it's still there, right? They're still selling.
It's still flattening and reducing the complexity of.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Thomas Penny has this great chapter in one of my edited volumes. And this is not me trying to sell books. But
feel free. I'm not against
it. It's called.
We have to do what we have to do.
It's called Gaze Under Glass, right? And he. Like that analogy of like, yeah, we're really reducing ourselves to a two-dimensional thing, to a two-dimensional person. And there's a lot more to people. Like I can tell you, I've been with people who are super attract, there's a, I don't know if I should say this, but there's a guy I'm kind of interested in right now. And I remember when we first met, I was like, this guy's into me. But it's because we didn't meet on the apps. We met in a three-dimensional space where we were connecting on like a way to, like, even now when I spend time with him, it's like the
it's
world.
Different path to attraction, right?
Yeah. What's that?
A different path. It's a different path to attraction.
Yeah. Right?
Because we're on the app, you're socialized to say, you look for the, I don't know, the features that you like or the skin color that you like that you were finding in your research, right? Or you're looking for an exact height or an exact build. And that's not how you interact with someone when you sit down with them or when you bump into them at a coffee shop or at the goth night, right? It's a different type of interaction.
Well, and that's funny because this guy I'm thinking of, we actually met at the goth night. But
we could just go 30 minutes telling the story of the goth night instead.
I mean, well, yeah, it's actually like probably one of my most memorable events. But anyway, these apps, they really kind of flatten out our qualities as human beings. It doesn't allow for nuance. It's instantaneous. Like I don't have to, I can sit in my chair and get on my phone and be on these apps. If I want to go out to like a gay bar, I've got to like, you know, I got to put some stuff on. I got to make myself look good.
Yeah.
And so in that way, the apps create this culture industry, right? Where people are reduced to objects and sold as commodities by Grindr or, you know, eHarmony or what else. And so that's my attraction to like the dating app stuff is how.
And you can also up your status through these are the people that I've been able to hook up with, which then it starts to commodify it even more, right?
Well, that's all. Like, let me tell you, that's always been the case in the gay world for sure. So like I'm old enough that I know a time before the dating apps and like, as they came out. And it's been very interesting to see how these apps kind of flatten our image, which again relates back to the electronic dance music because it's all about sucking the real human experience out and reducing us to commodities to be bought and sold.
Is there any positive of the dating apps? Is there any reason to celebrate them? Or after your research, would you say, you know, just such a net negative that, you know, burn it all down?
Well, increasingly, it is something I say burn it all down because there was a decision by Grindr to go public, and now they're involved with a corporation known as Palantir.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I'll let your students look that up on their own. But yeah. Essentially, Palantir is a massive surveillance system that that does a lot of things that I think are unethical in terms of like they have bots on these apps that try to increase your interaction, your time spent on the app. There's a level of monitoring that goes into this. They're using it for ICE raids.
Yeah.
They're using a couple different apps for ICE raids. But so now I am very, very, very anti-dating app. There was a period of time where I said humans could use this technology in different and exciting ways. And people do. Like, I used it when I was overseas, and it became a lifesaver for me as far as figuring out where to go, what to do. You know, I met some really lovely people on there. The way we use it here in the United States, though, is really different and really, you know, it's a very much a different world. But you know, it's very much about hooking up, not about anything more than that. And
so it not just flattens who the person is, it flattens what the experience is that you're going to have with them.
Yeah. My most memorable moments aren't necessarily moments where I took someone home from the gay bar. My most memorable moments, were, you know, just being out dancing with friends, like, yeah. You know, but increasingly what I see that app culture has done is it's turned going out into a constant kind of game of hookup, that David Grazian kind of writes about in his book On the Make. So,
all right. So for the final and potentially, I don't know if it's the most challenging question. I shouldn't say that. That sets a different tone for it. But the final question is thinking about your research, thinking about your experiences, is there a lesson or two? And you've kind of been doing this already, but I'm wondering if you could boil it down to a lesson or two that you would tell to students who are either going to read your research or hearing you talk about it. What would you say now that you've become an expert in these areas? Is there something that people can take into their own life from this?
Oh God.
I told you it might be the most difficult. I retracted that statement, but I do believe it. It's hard sometimes.
So lessons that they can learn, that they can take.
Yeah. Other than don't rely just on the dating apps, which is already one of the lessons.
I mean, I'm telling you what.
I mean, like, that's part of it. That is a real thing, though, right? Like, students are coming to the age where we're attached to our phones, so.
I do way better if I just go out. Like, but these apps make it so hard. Like, it's just like, well, I could go out or I could just, you know, order in.
yeah.
But I think the big lesson that I've learned from all this is that the online space is ultimately determined by what we do as human beings, right? And so, like, you know, for me, Grindr was a wonderful tool while I was backpacking across Europe and trying to figure out what the heck to do or where to go. And it's become a lot harder, though, because there's evidence to support the idea that they use bots or that they are engaging in some other kinds of behavior. But I would say, you know, honestly, get out there and experience the world, whether that be electronic dance music or something else. It's not to say that the online world doesn't have its place. Like, I've met some really cool people online through my activities on Twitch As a sociologist, like I'm kind of known as the sociologist on Twitch, there's a guy named Gary David, who's really the sociologist on Twitch, but, I think it's
a really useful lesson to hear from you, because in some ways the areas of scholarship that I found most convincing in being celebratory of more online interactions would be stories of, hey, I'm growing up gay in a rural area. It's like, how do I find anyone else having these experiences? So online provides this. And that research often came out in like the late 90s, early 2000s, when we could be more optimistic about what the online world would be. And so it's interesting for you to be saying like, look, I see that. I've lived some of that life, but it's like, don't get stuck on there, especially the way maybe something about what the corporations are doing with this technology has changed. But
yeah,
so that's COVID, why I think you giving that lesson is like a big deal.
COVID made it real hard. Like, I'll tell you, up until recently, I had a lot of post-COVID anxiety. Like, I actually was going to do this kind of ethnographic work about the gay circuit scene, so like gay raves, and I got to the venue and I just choked. I was like, I started having a panic attack, and I was so embarrassed because I went to great lengths to basically get access and all that. But yeah, it's an easy trap to get to fall into, and there's actually some research on this topic. And I think things have changed too. When Grindr first came out, it was owned by a guy in West Hollywood. And then it got sold to a tech company and became this, you know, a part of a multinational corporation. And that's when you started to see a change and a shift where everything became monetized. And, I think you're maybe looking for like what's the big lesson from your work?
I feel like you gave a kind of big lesson though, right? About embracing the messiness of the personal interaction, whether it leads to getting to have a quick hookup or not, right?
Yeah, I think that it goes a little farther than that too. Like, I think the whole point of my work is that we can determine how these technologies influence and shape our world, right? It's not just app makers and developers that, like, we as human beings, we have agency and we can turn our backs on these things too. And there are a lot of people doing that right now, specifically related to Grindr. I think I saw some parties in New York where they were like deleting their Grindr apps, which I thought, yes, that's cool. Because it's an interesting tool. It's just one that, you know, you shouldn't fully get absorbed with.
Yeah, I think that works as the takeaway lesson. In my mind, it does.
I'll take it.
No, this was a really fun conversation. You made me feel good about this project, so I call it a success.
Woo! I did the good thing today.
You did a good thing today. No, this is awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time. So thanks again for being the first conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciation goes to Jeffrey Gilbert for providing theme music, SUNY Brockport for providing financial support, and most importantly, on behalf of me, Kyle Green, thank you for giving Theory a chance.